Is it good? Too soft? Okay. Let me know if you're having trouble hearing in the back. All right, so I think what I'm going to do, Alex sent me some notes, at least probably enough to cover this session, but I think what I'm going to do is use a mixture of some of my talks, Alex's notes, and a lot of work actually on the board. So I'm going to do three types of things. I'm going to try to place this program, this convex operational approach, in context, especially of foundations and interpretations of quantum mechanics, because that's more or less the title of this course. Is that right? Yeah. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to give a pedagogical, as Joe said, introduction to the basic tools of this approach. And that should be the kind of thing where everybody should understand what I'm saying and why it's true, except when I say, here's a result that I'm not going to prove. So if people aren't understanding, I'm very happy to work at the board and explain what's going on until you're really satisfied that you understand. So please pipe up if you don't understand why something I'm claiming is true. And if it's something that's more appropriate to discuss at the end, I'll defer it to the end, but don't let that stop you from asking another question if you're confused later. So I really do want there to be back and forth and make sure that there's understanding. The third thing I'm going to do is cover some of the main results in this framework. And there, I am probably, in many cases, not going to give a proof, maybe give a rough idea of why a proof is true or why a statement is true. And there, the main point is that you should not necessarily understand why everything is true when there's a technical proof behind it, but at least understand what is being claimed. So again, pipe up and ask questions if you don't understand. This is meant to be very informal and pedagogical. All right, so with that, I'm going to be discussing in this lecture and probably the next something called which we like to call the generalized probabilistic or operational approach, or sometimes the convex operational approach to the foundations of quantum theory, and more generally to possible theories that are not necessarily quantum theory, but might be interesting to study, even though they may not be realized in the physical world, interesting to study as foils to quantum theory, to contrast with quantum theory, to understand better what quantum theory is by understanding what it's not, as Rod Spekins likes to say. Okay, and the basic approach of this operational convex approach is that whatever else quantum states are, and we can discuss this for a long time, and people have, they're compendia of probabilities for the outcomes of all possible measurements we might make on them, meaning actually on a physical system that is described by this quantum state. Okay, and what are quantum effects? In other words, POVM elements. So did you have POVM elements in your background? Everyone knows what those are. Positive, just the elements of positive semi-definite matrices between 0 and the identity matrix, the things that represent the outcomes of quantum measurements. So they are just compendia of probabilities for getting that measurement result in all possible states that you might do the measurement on. And so this is a very general idea, just states you might prepare and different possible measurements you might make on a system. And you can imagine that this general framework allows you to make up all kinds of possibilities that aren't necessarily classical theory or quantum theory. And indeed it does. So this is the framework we're going to use to investigate the nature of quantum theory and what quantum information is like and what that what the nature of information processing in quantum theory as compared to other abstract possibilities, what that can tell us about the essence of quantum theory, and perhaps that can help us in understanding how to interpret it. Okay, so this doesn't necessarily commit us to any particular interpretational view about what the quantum state is. We're just saying at least it's this. At least it gives us the probabilities for different, possibly mutually exclusive measurement outcomes that you could make. And, maybe it's also some physical object, like maybe the many-worlders think, or maybe there's some hidden variables behind it, who knows. But at least it does this. So this is kind of a common denominator. You're not committed to any interpretation, although people who spend a lot of time on this formalism frequently do tend towards the point of view that that's pretty much all the quantum state is. Right? Not everybody thinks that. But yes?
What interpretation do you use for probability, or do you just avoid that question?
So that was actually the next thing I was going to address. And so that's another thing that this approach is independent of, pretty much, is what your view is on the interpretation of probability. Probability, mathematically speaking, is clearly defined, right? It's just a bunch of numbers that add up to one in colloquial when you're looking at mutually exclusive alternatives, colloquially. And so it's mathematically well-defined, and that's really all we need to define our formalism for theories. It's just the mathematics of probability and the fact that different possible measurements have got to have well-defined probabilities for their outcomes in every state you might prepare for a system. Again, people working this framework, there does seem to be probably a preponderance of people who take a Bayesian viewpoint of probability. Although, Lucien has come up with a framework that is pretty much this same framework, and in his initial papers on it back around 2000, Lucien being Lucien Hardy, he sounded pretty frequentist, actually, in his interpretation. He said, you do a lot of experiments where you make each possible measurement a bunch of times, you get the frequencies of outcomes for each outcome, and then you represent those in this convex operational framework. I personally am pretty much Bayesian subjectivist, well, let's say decision theoretic, in my view of what probabilities are when they are used in the world or in a scientific theory, or when you just make a statement about what you think the probability of some event is. That means, basically, I think they are, when you assert that a probability of something, of some event is such and such, you're asserting something about the way you'd be willing to bet on that event, or more generally, take risky decisions based on what your beliefs about that event. So that doesn't necessarily mean that I think quantum probabilities are subjective in the sense that they can be whatever you want. I actually think that in many situations, the probabilities quantum mechanics, let's say the probabilities that quantum physics prescribes for a system are pretty much objective in the sense that, they are the right way to bet, right? I mean, you put a photon through a polarizing beam splitter, and if it comes out one side, you know things about what it's going to do in the future, when you make future measurements on it. For instance, if you put it through the same kind of polarizing splitter, it's going to go the same way. And that's an objective fact, as objective as any, fact in any scientific theory we have. You can always argue that, if you think hard enough, everything involves some element of subjective judgment. So for some quantum probabilities, I'm willing to say they're objective. But that doesn't mean that I think they're objects, right? You can have objective probabilities without them being entities out in the world, the way a many-worlder might think of the quantum state. So in that sense, I'm still taking a decision-theoretic view of probability. But I do want to emphasize that that's pretty much, you don't have to take that point of view or any other particular point of view to apply this convex framework. But it's naturally suited to just representing probabilities and not saying anything about the ontology of the underlying underlying system. So right. Okay, so we'll have this page up. So this general research program, as I mentioned, is to characterize quantum and classical theory within a broad framework of FOIL theories, described in this convex framework, and particularly to emphasize characterizations, maybe axiomatic characterizations, but where the axioms talk about the flow and processing of information. And that's That's one important aspect of this program. So there have been people working in this context sets framework since the 60s, and maybe if you count Mackey, the 50s. And there's kind of been a resurgence over the last 10 years, I would say, coincident with the rise of quantum information, a resurgence of interest in this context framework. And the new twist, one of the new twists, is this emphasis on information processing protocols. So another thing I think that's sort of a new ingredient is there's been a lot more emphasis on composite systems, tensor products. And that's also kind of stemming from quantum information because of the emphasis on entanglement theory, which involves composites of multiple systems. So why might you want to do this? Well, you know, there's sort of the pragmatic reasons, which maybe aren't as relevant in the foundational course, but you know, if you get a conceptual understanding of what principles underlie information processing tasks, like key distribution, which, you know, secret key distribution, which we know we can do better in quantum mechanics than classically, or maybe, you know, some computational speedups that you can do with quantum computing. If you get a conceptual understanding of what at some abstract level the principle is that underlies that, that might help you develop new protocols, understand the limits of quantum information processing, or maybe model information processing and flow in other complex systems. And then there are the more hubristic motivations for this, and maybe they're the most relevant to this course. You know, there are a lot of people who think information and probabilities are the essence of quantum physics. John Wheeler's idea of it from bit is an example of that. And this is a natural framework for understanding the nature of information in quantum theory. And then some people even think that a characterization of quantum mechanics, so an axiomatic, you know, a set of assumptions that would enable you to derive quantum mechanics as, say, the only theory satisfying these assumptions, those might constitute an analog of Einstein's principle-based accounts of special and general relativity. So a new way of understanding the nature of quantum physics that's just compelling operationally. That's pretty hubristic, as I said, but that's maybe the aspect of this program that's most interesting from a foundational point of view. You know, I guess I would say that the founders of quantum mechanics, to some extent, realized this, right? The radical principles that underlie quantum information processing were recognized by the founders. I mean, the disturbance of states by measurement being a process of acquiring information, that was very early recognized. Schrodinger has a beautiful quote characterizing entanglement in terms that really are quite probabilistic and, in fact, relate to convexity. The best possible knowledge of a total system does not necessarily include total knowledge of all its parts, not even when these are fully separated from each other and at the moment are not influencing each other at all. So the way I would interpret this in the convex framework is to say, you know, he's saying even if we have the best possible knowledge of a total system, and that's pure state, a state that cannot be represented as a convex combination of other states, we don't necessarily have total knowledge of all its parts. In other words, we don't necessarily have a pure state for the subsystems. And in fact, entangled quantum states, any non-product pure quantum state, has a mixed reduced density matrix, a mixed marginal state on one of the systems. All right. And of course, there might end up being many illuminating characterizations or axiomatizations of quantum mechanics. It's not like we're looking for the one. I mean, maybe there is the one that everyone will recognize as best. But maybe there are many alternative ways of axiomatically deriving quantum mechanics in terms of information processing, or maybe in terms of other mathematically beautiful principles. And each of them might give us some illumination. And in fact, there are some existing characterizations or partial characterizations. There's Lucian Hardy's work from 2001 or so. Mauro Dariano has a bunch of papers and his collaborators at Pavia that go some way towards characterizing quantum mechanics. Various earlier ones, Alfsane and Schultz, I'll talk about their characterization later, from like the 70s, Iraqi. And some work in the quantum logic tradition that I won't cover, but it's nice to remember exists and maybe look into. All right. At this point, I think I will switch presentations. This is something Alex mostly prepared. Okay. So we're going to start with a notion that is very operational, and it's what I think Dave Fallis called a test space, and his collaborator Charlie Randall back in the maybe late 70s, early 80s. In fact, they initially called it a manual, which is kind of an interesting name. The idea behind manual being that it's like a manual for doing all the possible experiments you can do on a system. And for some reason, they changed it. Test space. So it's a collection, this is a German capital A, Fraktur A, of non-empty sets, and the sets are called tests. And what we understand each of these sets as being the set of outcomes of some measurement or experiment or test. And of course, these don't have to be thought of as laboratory tests, right? They could be sort of things that happen in the world that have different outcomes, and you didn't necessarily have to set it up. But the terminology does suggest a laboratory of test, certainly manual. Okay, so if we take the X, the collection of all elements in these sets, so the union of these sets, that's the outcome space for this test space. It's a set of every outcome that occurs in at least one of these tests, right? Some of the outcomes can occur in more than one of the tests. So let me just give you a concrete, or as concrete as things get in this business, example to think about, which we'll use later. So these brackets denote sets. And since a test space is a set of sets, here are the two sets in this test space, A and A prime and B and B prime. So there are two possible experiments in this test space. And each experiment has two outcomes, which I'm labeling A, A prime, and B, B prime. Okay, so just to have a little bit more concrete example. And this test space is actually related to something called a Popescu-Rohrlich box. Have you heard of those yet? No. Okay. So maybe I'll just start giving some background on Popescu-Rohrlich boxes and correlations, since you're going to be doing a Bell inequality experiment, and these are related to that. So this is an example of the kind of thing that motivates studying this abstract framework. People ask, you know, why does quantum mechanics have this or that property? Well, could it have been otherwise? Is there some deep principle such that any theory that satisfies this principle has to have this property? So think about the property of satisfying, think about Bell inequalities. So you've probably seen the Bell CHSH inequality, and that says that for observables A1 and A2 at Alice's site, and B1 and B2 at Bob's site, hope this is right, such that their outcomes that their outcomes have values somewhere between -1 and +1, so somewhere in this closed interval, then this particular correlation, right, the expectation value of this particular sum of correlations of Alice's operators and Bob's operators, it's less than or equal to 2 if Alice's and Bob's statistics are described by a local hidden variable theory, and that's the Bell inequality. It turns out that in quantum mechanics, you can derive, and a guy named Sir Elson did derive, that these, sometimes it's spelled with a C here, these are, this expectation value, while it can violate 2, it could be bigger than 2, it's less than or equal to 2 root 2. So back in the 80s, I think, Sandu Popescu and Daniel Roerlich asked, well, what's behind this 2 root 2? Could you have a reasonable theory in which correlations were even stronger than quantum mechanics allows? Right? Quantum correlations are stronger than hidden variable correlations, local hidden variable correlations. But could you have a stronger one, or is there some simple principle that says basically it had to be like it is in quantum mechanics? Any reasonable theory would be like that. So in particular, they asked whether no signaling implies Sir Elson. In other words, implies this bound of 2 root 2. And what does no signaling mean? It basically means that whatever Alice does at her side, she can't instantaneously change the statistics of measurements at Bob's side. She can't do anything at her side that he can detect without direct communication, just by acting on his side of this correlated state. So does that notion make sense to people intuitively, what no signaling is? Okay, so they asked, does no signaling imply Sir Elson? This was Popescu and Roerlich. And the answer was no. You can get 4. Get a value of 4 there with a set of correlations that are still non-signaling. You can't use them for instantaneous signaling. But you can get this value that is basically as high as probability theory will allow for these correlations.
I mean, there are things that, obviously there's things that Alice can do over here that affects what happens over here. I mean, that's why we get the 2 root 2 to begin with. So, but what do you mean? Is there a more formal way of saying this?
There is. I think that's, so I'm likely to do that, or maybe if Alex is here next week, he'll do it a bit later in the lecture. But yeah, so maybe I should postpone that. But let me just say that we view these correlations between these observables as derived from some state, right? And this is a bipartite state, and it gives probabilities for every possible measurement that Alice and Bob might do, and maybe also for some measurements that they can't do individually, but somebody who had both systems could do. And the point is, you can define a marginal state where you say, let's suppose Alice did some measurement, and now there are conditional states on Bob's side that are the states Bob would have conditional on each of Alice's possible measurement outcomes. And if you average those conditional states with the probabilities for, so average Bob's conditional states weighted by the probabilities of Alice getting the results that the states are being conditioned on, you get what's called the marginal state. And the point is that this is a well-defined state that is independent of which measurement Alice chooses to make. No matter what measurement Alice chooses to make, when you average over her measurement results, which Bob has got to do unless she's been talking to him, you get the same state, the same marginal state on Alice's side. So she can't, just by choosing a measurement, affect the state he has. I mean, you can tell that there are correlations, and you can verify that there's Bell inequality violations and so forth by talking about your measurement outcomes, right? By looking at both Alice's and Bob's and seeing that, wow, they have these strong correlations that can't be explained by local invariable theory. But that doesn't mean that there could be signaling, that there could be any effect of this entanglement that is detectable without communication, without pooling the measurement results. So does that help a bit? A little bit. Okay, it'll be defined more formally later. So,
So the point is, with this
no signaling assumption, even with the no signaling assumption, you can get this value of 4 for these correlations. And Popescu and Rohrlich. So I wrote PR up here. Sandu Popescu and Daniel Rohrlich. And the point is, the setup they used to show this involved two test spaces of this sort. So maybe A and B weren't good choices here. A and B are, let's say, alternative measurements that Alice could make. And then Bob has a similar system. Two possible measurements, alternative measurements, each of which has two possible outcomes. And then we define a correlated state of those two systems, Alice's and Bob's. And you can define a correlated state on that that achieves this value of 4, even though it's not signaling. And so we'll do that later. So a probability weight, or I just like to call it a state, on a test space is just a mapping from all the outcomes of all the tests to probabilities, right? Elements of the interval 0, 1. And it's a state if, when you pick any particular test, E, and you add up over all the outcomes in E, the probability of that outcome, you get 1. So a state assigns probabilities to all the outcomes of every possible measurement in such a way that when you pick any particular measurement, the probabilities add up to 1. Is that pretty clear? Okay. And now, the set, which we usually call omega, or omega of A, to emphasize its dependence on the test space, of all possible probability weights on the test space is called the state space of that test space. And actually, I like to call it the maximal state space, because there may well be situations where you define a test space, and then you put some restriction on the states that you're going to allow. So you say, I'm picking some omega that is a subset of the set omega of all possible probability weights on the state space, right? In fact, yeah, there are situations, for instance, even in quantum mechanics where you do that. So, okay, but before I go on to examples, is this notion fairly clear, or, yeah?
Is there anything more to this than just, like, renaming Kolmogorov axioms? It seems like these are
not much more. No. It's basically just saying, it's like Kolmogorov's axioms,
except that there are alternative possible measurements. And they're not necessarily all compatible, right? You can't view any measurement as a coarse graining of some single underlying measurement. So in a classical test space, there's only... So one way of formulating classical probability theory is to give a test space that has only one test, right? And then you can imagine that there are other measurements which aren't represented as tests, but they're just coarse grainings of measurements, this one measurement. So the point is, this test-based notion allows you to be sort of non-commutative in that you say there are many different possible measurements I could make. There are all these outcomes, this set X, but there isn't necessarily a test that contains every outcome in X. Just like, you know, there's no measurement in quantum mechanics whose outcomes are all possible. Yes?
Is the test space something that, like if I gave you a set of observables, then would you give me a test space? Or is it the case that the test space is something associated with all possible observables in any possible state? But like, what do I need to specify in order for you to specify a test state for me? Test space, rather.
Okay, so I mean, I would have to know what you mean by observables.
Well, I don't know, positive operators, let's say.
So I mean, then you're already in a quantum mechanical framework.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
Maybe what I'll do is, I mean, this is a very abstract framework. I can tell you some ways of associating test spaces with quantum theory. Would that maybe be helpful?
It would be helpful, but let's just restrict ourselves like temporarily to a quantum framework, right?
Uh-huh.
In a quantum framework, unless I specify a set of observables, then you can't meaningfully define a test space like this, right? Because if I don't specify those observables, then you can choose non-commuting sets of observables, like you said, and you won't be able to satisfy the Kolmogorov axioms, and then probability won't be.
You can get them all into a test space, right? I mean, you could put the outcomes of non-commuting sets of observables all into a test space, because the tests will only contain the outcomes of commuting sets of observables.
All right, that's fine.
So does that make some sense?
Yes.
So maybe this will help a little bit. Okay, classically,
it's simple. Let's just take finite classical probability theory over finite number of outcomes. Well, you just take a finite set. Omega is delta of this set, the so-called simplex of probability weights on the set. And it's very simple. So there's just one test, which is a single finite set. Okay, quantum mechanics. So let's let our test space be the set of orthonormal bases for some Hilbert space H. Okay. So unordered orthonormal bases, they're just sets. So if this is a finite dimensional Hilbert space, right, this test space is what's called locally finite. Each test is a finite set. But the overall test space isn't finite, right? It's continuously infinite because there's a continuous infinity of bases. Okay, so that's sort of what the test space looks like. And then what is omega of H? What is the set of all possible? So what is the set of all possible tests? Maybe that should have been omega of F of H. Well, we know from Gleason's theorem. Have you had Gleason's theorem yet? Okay. Well, Gleason's theorem basically says that the state space of this test space, when the dimension is greater than 2, is just the density matrices. In other words, to every vector x, so Alex has written, this inner product of rho x with x, that's just another way of writing, you know, x, rho x in standard Dirac notation. So this is the rule for determining the probabilities. They add up to 1 on every orthonormal basis. So this is a state on the test space. Any density matrix determines a state on the test space. And for dimension greater than 2, every state on that test space is determined that way. Yes?
Yes, it is 1-to-1
for dimension greater than 2. For a qubit, there are actually states in this sense on the test space of a qubit that are not quantum states. And that's why Gleason's theorem is stated for dimension h greater than 2. Yes?
Gleason's theorem originally stated for bigger than 3, and then he himself refined it, or you mean someone else refined it to take it up to 2?
Oh, no, it's never been taken up to 2. So
I thought the original Gleason theorem was for dimension bigger than 3.
It is. So it's greater than 2. Sorry. Right. And so for qubit, there are other states that are not quantum states on that test space. Now, if you make a slightly different test space where you include POVMs as tests, then there's an analog to Gleason's theorem even for dimension 2 that says you only have the quantum states. You have to be a little careful if you want to make a test space out of POVM elements, but I believe you can do it. You could take so here's another way of formulating quantum mechanics as the state space of a test space. Let's take as tests all POVMs with only rank 1 elements. And
no repeated elements. Right? The point is, you can actually have a given POVM element occur twice in a given test, right? If it's far enough below the identity operator. In a given POVM. But the way we define tests, you can't have an outcome occur twice. So if you don't allow repetitions, you can take all POVMs, let's say with rank one POVM elements, as your test space. And then the state space of that will be just determined by the quantum density matrices, one-to-one correspondence with quantum density matrices, even for a qubit. All right, so that illustrates an interesting point, which is that for a probabilistically described system like quantum mechanics, and I'll be more precise about what I mean by a probabilistically described system in the next slide, there isn't necessarily a unique test space associated with it. There may be different test spaces such that the state space is the set of all states on that test space. So for quantum mechanics, there is this possibility of either just taking orthonormal bases or taking rank one POVMs, for instance. And there are probably ways of throwing in even other POVMs. I haven't really thought about that. Yes?
The probabilities you assign to POVMs is independent of tests. It's something that you assign to the POVM, and it's the same in all tests.
Yes.
Is it something that comes from those definitions, or?
It is assumed in the, yeah, it is implied.
It's part of the definition of a state here, right? Because we said a probability weight or a state is a mapping from the outcome set to 0, 1. And a given outcome might occur in different tests. But since we're defining a state as just assigning a probability to the outcome, it's the same probability no matter what test it occurs in. So yes, in that sense, our definition of a state on a test space is a non-contextual state. Right. That's an important point. Thanks. A contextual state would say, well, we don't have a mapping from outcomes to probabilities. We have a mapping from outcomes and tests, pairs of an outcome and the test it's occurring in to a probability. That would be a contextual state assignment. Now, of course, you could always replace a contextual state assignment by saying, well, I'm just going to go to a different test space where every outcome that occurs in more than one test, I just mark it with which test it's occurred in, and I make a new test space in which no outcome occurs in more than one test, and then I've made the formerly contextual state non-contextual by just making which state, which tests it's in, be part of the label of the outcome. So it's not really a strongly restricting assumption. Yeah, but I mean, there are situations in which you might, for some reason, want to say, you know, I have some a priori reason for calling this the same outcome in different tests. And then maybe it would really mean something if it had different probabilities in different tests. So it's nice that we've got the flexibility. Actually, we don't have the flexibility here to have contextual states. So, and that's just a point to note. No, sorry, quantum mechanics is not contextual in this sense. So maybe I shouldn't have used the word contextual, although I think it was probably used first. This is not Rob Speckin's sense of contextual, non-contextual, as far as whether or not you can have a contextual hidden variable, non-contextual hidden variable theory of it. This is just saying that the probabilities of outcomes don't depend on their context, where the context is the test it occurs in. So, you know, in quantum mechanics, the probability of getting a particular measurement outcome in a particular state doesn't depend on what other POVM elements occur in that POVM. It could occur in many different POVMs, but it's going to have the same probability as long as you're measuring it on the same state. So I think Gleason used this term, non-contextual states, for his theorem. Okay, so Alex likes to point out that classical and quantum state spaces, test spaces, and he's thinking now of this set of orthonormal bases as the test space, have a lot in common. For every outcome, there's a unique state that makes that outcome certain. And also, every state can be expressed uniquely as a convex combination of, so for every state, you can find some test such that the state is just a convex combination, in fact, given by the probabilities of getting outcome X of that test, of the states that make that outcome certain. That's a condition that you might call sort of weak spectrality of states, right? In quantum mechanics, I mean, this is just the fact that you can expand the density matrix as rho equals some I, let's call it rho sub I, where this is the diagonalizing basis for your density matrix. So have you guys encountered this? Okay. Right, I mean, this is the spectral decomposition in quantum theory, if you like. And the point is that's a very special property, but you can formulate it in general in a test-based framework. And not all theories will have that property. Yes?
I'm going to go back to Joe's comment. If you require probabilities to only be 0 and 1, then are the two notions of non-contextual the same, as in the quotient specker, non-contextuality, and this notion? If you require 0, 1, only 0, 1.
I believe that's true.
Okay.
Yeah. That is true. Okay. I'm going to skip this example.
Okay. So you guys have encountered the notion of convexity before? Right. So if we look at the set of all states on a test space, it's going to be convex. In other words, it's closed under convex combination, right? T and 1 minus T, where both of these are positive, or at least non-negative. And under weak conditions, such as this local finiteness I mentioned, every test is a finite set, it's topologically closed. And so it's compact, right? A compact set in finite dimensional real space is just closed, topologically closed, and it's bounded, which means you can fit it inside some ball of finite radius. And the important thing about having the state space be compact is that there's this theorem called the Krein-Milman theorem. That says that any point in a convex compact set can be represented as a convex combination of extreme points. And in fact, if we're in finite dimensions, you only need a finite number of these extremal points. And what extremal points are is they are points that can't be represented as a non-trivial convex combination of other points. So for instance, if we take a triangle, right, these three points are the extreme points. Because if you have a point here, that's maybe half of this one plus half of that one gives you that one. And a point in the middle, you can take maybe a third of each of these and get that point. So only these guys are convex, right? If this were are extremal. Okay. So note that the extremal points are not necessarily the entire boundary of this thing. If you take another example, like the circle, all the points on the boundary are extremal, but that's not necessarily the case. Okay. So a classical state space in convex terminology is what's called a simplex. And the definition of a simplex is just, at least in finite dimensions, it's the, so let's say a simplex in d-dimensional real space is just the convex hull of d plus 1 points. And I guess you could also include, right, fewer points. You just have a smaller simplex embedded in a large space. But right, so for example, a triangle is a simplex because the board is like R2, and we have 3 points that we took the convex hull of. Okay, and that's, you know, that's the convex structure of classical state spaces. You can always look at them in d-dimensional real space when you have d plus 1 outcomes and just take the convex hull. There is an interesting characterization of simplices or equivalent definition, which is to say that a simplex is a convex compact set in which the decomposition of a point into extremal points is unique, right? So by Krein-Milman, you always can represent, well, I erased Krein-Milman, but you always can represent any point in the set as a convex combination of extremal points. There's a strengthening of that called Carathéodory's theorem that says, in fact, that in finite dimensions, you never need more than d plus 1 extremal points to represent it. And a set is a simplex if and only if the representation as a convex combination of extreme points is unique. And that's a property that actually has implications for the nature of information in non-classical theories that violate it. So it's a good one to remember. I don't think Alex explicitly put it in these notes. I guess what he's saying here is just, you know, look at this middle point. It's a one-third, one-third, one-third mixture of each of these. You know, you can also make it out of, for instance, this point beta and this point delta x, and then it's a two-thirds of beta, one-third of delta x mixture. But then if you expand beta into its unique decomposition of extremal points, you get back to the same one-third, one-third, one-third decomposition. So when you write it all out in terms of extreme points, you get, so we go till when, 4, is that right? Or quarter 2, okay. All right. So for contrast, let's look at a square. And you can immediately see, here's this point in the center. It's equal to one-half this plus one-half that. It's also equal to one-half this plus one-half that. And these four guys are the extremal points, right? The points that are called pure states, if you like. They can't be represented as convex combinations of other points. So here's an illustration of the non-uniqueness. And this square, by the way, is the state space of that test space I wrote up there. So let me just point out why that is. So I guess, you know, this might be called a PR bit for Pesky-Rohrlich. In our latest paper, a bunch of us called it a squit for a square bit. And the way to think of it is, well, here are the extreme points. So we can represent a state by the probabilities for A prime, B, and B prime. Those are our four elements of the test space. And here are the extremal states. Basically, the extremal states assign a definite outcome to each of the two possible tests. So we've got 1, 0, 1, 0. We get the unprimed outcome, no matter which we do. We get 0, 1, 0, 1. We get the primed outcome, no matter what we do. And then, of course, there's 1, 0, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 1, 0, where one of the things, if we do one test, we get the primed outcome. If we do the other test, we get the unprimed outcome. That's this last one. Yes. Yeah. Right, because basically you only need to specify two numbers to specify a state here, right? Because once you specify the probability for this outcome, you know the probability of that outcome. And once you specify the probability for this outcome, you know the probability of that outcome. And these two numbers can vary between 0 and 1, right? And so basically, we're just letting A go from 0 to 1 here, and B go from 0 to 1 here, let's say. And so these outcomes would be, let's say, 0. Okay, we have probably for A being 0. So we have 0, 1, and then these are the B outcomes, also 0, 1. Up here, we've let the A outcome go to 1, so we have 0, 1, 1, 0. We've let the A outcome change to the primed one. And then over here, we're going to go to 1, 0, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 0, 1. Right. But the main thing is just think of this coordinate as representing the probability of A, and this coordinate is representing the probability of B. And then you can just have any convex combination of those. So the state space is a square. Oops. Yes.
Situation that those probability doesn't necessarily go to one. I mean, you imagine, I mean, there's a limit. For example, the maximum probability is point in any test is 0.9.
So for this test space, if you look at the set of all possible states, you get this situation.
The definition is that you have to have a test for which the probability can be one or not.
I don't think it comes from the definition that you. So you mean?
So I think you're asking, does the formalism allow for a test space in which there would be no
certain outcomes?
No certain outcomes, yeah.
So it certainly allows, I believe it allows for outcomes that cannot be made certain by any state, right, just because of combinatorial restrictions. Yeah.
So, I'm asking, the test space doesn't uniquely specify this convex set.
It does. It does. I mean, this is the set of all possible states that satisfy that the probabilities add up to 1 on this test and the probabilities add up to 1 on that test. So if you wanted to, by hand, put in a restriction, you could choose a smaller compact convex set than the set of all possible states. Right? Just like if you want to describe a qubit with orthonormal bases, you in fact have to do that to rule out these non-quantum states. So in representing a system, you know, if you do a bunch of experiments and you observe that, you know, nothing you can do allows you to prepare these points out at the end, you might represent things with the same test space but a different convex set that consists of the states that actually experimentally you seem to be able to prepare. But that's a restriction on the test space. But that can be an important kind of thing to be able to do, particularly if you want to, make theories that have nice hidden variable theories behind them. You may have to put in these restrictions by hand, like Rotstegen's information, restrictions on how much information you can get out of a system. Was there another question? Yeah.
Just to make sure what you were saying earlier, you said that in a simplex, every point must have that kind of composition and has to be unique in terms of the extremals. Is that what you said earlier? Was that?
Yes. A simplex is a convex compact set, right, in which the decomposition of any point into its extremal points is unique.
Right. So then this square is not a simplex.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the other definition I gave was that it's the convex hull of d+1 points, or d+1 or fewer points in RD.
Okay.
And this thing is in R2, and it's convex hull of 4 points. So the two definitions agree, which is good. Yes?
But that square can be built up out of these convex sets? So are these somehow kind of fundamental?
It is convex.
Out of the simplexes.
When you mean built up out of simplexes, do you mean like...
Because it looks like four triangles.
Triangular.
Maybe it's just... maybe I shouldn't extend the analogy too far, but are the simplices somehow fundamental to the... can you build up any state space?
Well, I suppose you could build up any...
simplices?
You know, I suppose any finite dimensional state space is a... you can view it as a convex hull of an infinite number of simplices, but that's maybe not all that limiting. and I'm not sure what the operational significance of the fact that you could triangulate this, or in fact you could triangulate any polyhedron. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the operational significance of that would be, but certainly you could do it. It's something to keep in mind if it looks like it's going to be useful.
So, quick question.
Yes.
So all the points in this theory have to lie in the interior of that square, right? Is that the idea?
All the points, or on the boundary, yeah.
Or on the boundary.
Yeah.
And then, so if we were to take quantum mechanics as an example, the boundary would represent the pure states, and the interior would be the...
In quantum mechanics, the topological... So let's take a couple of examples. If you look at real quantum mechanics, right, so that you just have a real Hilbert space and the states on that, a real qubit,
a real bit, its state space is, in fact, this circle. And in that case, you're right. The topological boundary would be the pure states. Okay, same if you look at a complex qubit, right? The state space, you guys probably know this, is a ball in R3, right? The so-called Bloch sphere. So I'm drawing kind of a longitudinal great circle, or a couple of them. So you got the Bloch ball. That's also a case in which the boundary, the topological boundary, is the pure states. When you go to higher dimension in quantum mechanics, that's no longer true, right? And the way to see it is that if you look at the density matrices that maybe have, P1, P2, and 0 on the diagonal, and 0 off the diagonal because you've diagonalized it, a small perturbation here gets you a negative eigenvalue, and that means it takes you out of the convex compact set of quantum states. But you didn't go out through the pure states. You went out through a mixed state. So it is like there are these edges in quantum mechanics, and you can go out through the edge. And these are not pure states. So quantum mechanics has this feature also, that there are mixed states on boundary as well as pure states in general. Just not for a qubit, which is one of the ways in which qubits are special. Okay. All right. In quantum mechanics, we also study the space of unnormalized states. And I think I should point out that what I'm doing now is I'm kind of going away from the test-based formalism, and I'm just looking at the convex structure of state spaces. And then I'm going to start talking about what a mathematical representation of measurements on a convex state space, which may be different than the test space you started with. It's sort of the representation of all possible measurements. So it's like going from orthonormal measurements as your test space, getting the quantum state space, and then saying, hey, I can think of some other mathematically reasonable measurements that are POVMs and that people didn't talk about for a long time, but they're just as good. They're logically consistent. And it turned out that was a good idea. So we're going to go to a framework like that, where we just have a convex compact state space and a generalized notion of POVM, of measurements, that's also described in convex terms and not in terms of some underlying test space. Okay, so the mathematical framework we need for that is the notion of cone. So a cone is just a subset of a real vector space that is closed under non-negative scalar multiplication. Closed under addition, that's what makes it convex. And we're going to take our cones to be pointed. So if you take the intersection of the cone and minus the cone, it's 0. What it really means is it doesn't contain any full line. So there should be a concrete example on the next page. Okay. Before we go to a concrete example, If you have a cone in a vector space, it induces what's called a partial ordering on that vector space. So we say that one element is less than another if their difference is in this positive cone. And so this is like saying, right, one POVM element is larger than another if the difference between the two is also a positive semi-definite operator. And the point is, this is a nice ordering. You can add inequalities, you still get an inequality. You can multiply inequalities by positive scalars, and you still have an inequality. So we call it an ordered linear space. And the main reason for mentioning this is just because people in this formalism will talk a lot about ordered linear spaces. And it's just the same thing as saying, I have a real vector space, I choose a convex cone in that vector space, and I'm thinking of that convex cone as either being unnormalized states or unnormalized measurement outcomes. But the mathematical formalism is this notion of ordered linear space. So it's good to know that terminology, even though we could just get by with talking about cones and not use it. Okay, so does this notion of an ordering that comes from a cone make sense to everybody? Okay. So what is the cone of unnormalized states for classical theory? Let's say classical probability theory on a finite set of outcomes. It's just the positive orthant, right? So I've got my R3, let's say. We'll have three outcomes. I've got my simplex, which I'm going to represent by these vectors, let's say 1, 0, 0. Maybe this is 0, 1, 0. Actually, probably it should be 0, 0, 1, and 0, 1, 0. Those are my unit vectors. The convex hull is this surface here, this simplex. And then the unnormalized states, right, the sets of positive multiples of probability distributions, is just this whole orthant that's pointing out towards you, the whole positive orthant. Okay, and that's a cone because it's a union of rays pointing out from the origin. It's closed under positive scalar multiplication. So that's how we represent unnormalized state spaces, and it's how we represent unnormalized sets of measurement outcomes. Yes?
You get the simplex by normalizing the states in the cone.
Yes, absolutely. And so, in fact, what we're going to define as an abstract state space, or one way of defining it, is just to specify a vector space, which is ordered, so it actually has a cone, which we'll call A plus, some positive cone, and then an element of the dual space. So this is a functional from the vector space A to just real numbers, and it's strictly positive on this cone A. And then we just look at the hyperplane where this functional takes the value 1. And that's cuts through this cone and cuts out, in this classical case, it cuts out this triangle, and that's the normalized states. And in fact, what U sub A is in this classical case is just U sub A of x equals x1 plus x2 plus x3, right? Perfectly good linear functional to the reals. And it's the norm, if you like. It tells you which states are normalized. And it picks out this convex compact set, which is called a base for the cone. Yeah. Okay. So here's where Alex defines a base for the cone. It's just a convex set such that every unnormalized state in the cone is some unique multiple of a state in that base. So here we've got our rebit, right, our state space, normalized state space for a real quantum bit, if you like, as the base for just an ordinary looking ice cream cone type cone. And these cones would have a ball as their base. They're sometimes called Lorentz cones. Okay. So it's quarter of, and or just about quarter of? Another five, okay. Probably get quite a bit done in five.
storage. Okay, let me just, I think what I'll just try to cover is how we define effects. So if you encounter the term effect, it's sort of the convex sets jargon for POVM elements, but it's the generalized notion of POVM elements. So an effect is a element of a dual space. It's a linear functional. So it's just a function from the unnormalized state space, the whole vector space, in fact, to the reals, such that for any state in the normalized state space, the base for this cone, let's give it a name, E. E of alpha is a probability. And that's how we're going to represent in the convex framework, as opposed to the test-based framework, a reasonable notion of measurement outcome. If it gives you a probability for every state, and it does so in a linear way, then it's a reasonable way of calculating the probability of a measurement outcome. And the reason we want to do it in a linear way is basically so it preserves convex combination, because that is the way that we ensure that if I, let's say, prepare a convex combination of two different states and obtain a given measurement outcome, the probability with which I get a given measurement outcome is that same convex combination of the probabilities for getting it in one state or the other state, right? Because somebody could, I mean, you don't in fact know, you know, there's probably no way the measuring apparatus should know whether, you know, someone prepared a convex combination or prepared this one or that one. So that's an operationally reasonable requirement. Okay, and so since these things have to be positive on everything in this base for the cone, and everything in the whole cone is just some positive multiple of that, these things have to be positive on the whole cone of unnormalized states. So linear functionals maps to the reals that are positive on every element of a cone are elements of what's called the dual cone of that cone. And I guess the dual cone, the cone is K, the dual cone is usually represented as K star. And if K is in some vector space V, K star is in V star. V star for a vector space V is just the space of functions from V to the real numbers, which are the underlying field. So effects or measurement outcomes are elements of the dual cone. And then it turns out that the fact that they have to be bounded above by one, that their values on normalized states have to be bounded above by one, that can be represented by just saying that effects have to be less than or equal to this unit effect. So effects are elements of the interval between 0 and this unit effect that we defined. This unit effect is 1 on all states in the dual cone. And this way of writing things, of saying they're above 0 but below U sub A, has kind of an interesting geometric way that you can express it. So let me just take the case where the cone is R2 plus, right? Classical theory, here are our two pure states. Here's the simplex, which is just a line. And this whole orthant is the positive cone. And now we go out to this U sub A, the unit functional. Sorry, so I'm talking about the effect space, not the state space. So this is where you measure to see if you're in one pure state. This is where you measure to see if you're in the other pure state. And this is the unit functional. And so to say you're below U sub A just means you take the negative of the cone, you attach it at U sub A, and you look at everything below it. And so here, this is that initial interval, 0 U sub A, for a two-outcome classical effect space. Okay, and so I think I'll leave it at that for now. And that's this notion of effects and states in dual cones is the basic mathematical framework for this convex operational framework. And then we'll do some applications next time. Or Alex.
Time for a few questions.
I guess I'm the only speaker. Are these carbons to be posted somewhere, or
we can do that. Yeah, I will probably. I did cover a fair amount of material that's not in the PowerPoint.
Yeah,
there's stuff in the PowerPoint.
Well, there's like some video tape. I gave you the slides off.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, we'll post these on the website. We can get the IT staff to do that.
Okay. And maybe I'll throw in, another talk as well, so you have an alternate source for some of the stuff that I just did on the
board. Thanks, Howard. Okay.